Why you are busy enjoying your lunch, why you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening, we ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On The Reading News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station, that is Eagle FM. I am your host, Nafa Happy Juju, and today is Tuesday, the 28th of April, 2026. Now, as the week gains momentum, attention shifts from intention to early execution across the country from Swakopmund to Rundu, Uchiwarungu to Rudwitz, and Katimamulilo to Hobabas, the pace of activity is beginning to take shape, offering early signals of how the coming days may unfold. Now, today we focus on traction, which sectors are moving from planning into action, and where are we seeing early signs of delivery, and where might changes already be surfacing? Those are the indicators that often define how the rest of the week develops. Now, Namibia's economic outlook remains firmly in focus. Development in green industrialization, infrastructure rollout, and investment positioning continue to shape the country's trajectory within an increasingly competitive global landscape. Now, at this stage of the week, responsiveness and coordination are key as both public and private sector players begin to translate strategy into measurable progress. Young Namibians, of course, always remain a driving force behind much of this momentum. From startups to digital platforms, innovation is not slowing down. It is rather accelerating. Now, the critical question now is whether institutional frameworks, financing mechanisms, and policy environments are actually keeping a pace with this wave of initiative. We're also tracking governance in motion. Beyond policy announcements, attention is turning to implementation, how effectively plans are being executed, how well institutions are aligning, and whether early outcomes reflect stated priorities. Where progress is visible, we'll definitely highlight it, and where gaps emerge, we'll take a closer look. And as always, we remain grounded in the realities on the ground, because national direction ultimately matters most when it translates into tangible change in people's daily lives. Now, over the next 1 hour and 30 minutes, do expect sharp insight, forward-looking analysis, and conversations that set the tone for the days ahead. Now, right here on The Reader, we don't just report on the story, but rather we track its direction. Stay tuned for more. Let's get right into these discussions, of course, which we left off yesterday. Now, the Ministry of Fisheries, Water and Land Reform has convened a four-day ministerial review and strategic planning workshop in Swakopmund that brings together senior government officials to assess performance and set priorities for the year ahead. The workshop, which began yesterday and is set to run until the 30th of April, serves as a key internal platform for evaluating process or progress across the ministry's core sectors, that being the fisheries, the water management, and the land reform. Attendees include executive leadership, departmental heads, and technical experts tasked with aligning operations to national development goals. Of course, the minister, Inger Zamekami, is also among the attendees. According to officials from the ministry familiar with the proceedings, the review component involves detailed assessment of departmental performance, including budget execution, project implementation, and service delivery outcomes. Particular attention is also being given to identifying gaps in meeting targets, as well as addressing challenges fragged with oversight reports. Now, in the fisheries sector, discussions are expected to focus on stock sustainability, on quota management, and enforcement measures against illegal fishing activities. The water division is reviewing ongoing infrastructure projects, which I believe is very critical and necessary at this particular point in time, and strategies to improve supply resilience in drought-affected regions, While land reform deliberations are centered on land redistribution progresses and the productivity of resettled farms. Now, the strategic planning segment of the workshop aims to establish measurable targets and refine policy direction in line with Namibia's broader development frameworks. Also, what is expected is prioritizing resource allocation under current fiscal constraints and identifying both short-term interventions and long-term reforms. Swakopmund remains a preferred venue for such engagements due to its established conference facilities and relative distance from routine administration demands, allowing for focused deliberations. And of course, at this juncture, let's take a listen from Minister Inge Zamwi Kamwi as we listen to some of the priorities she's focusing on or bringing on the table, especially in the aspect of the water part of the ministry. Let's take a listen.
Please, colleagues, we have a very serious responsibility which calls for unity and common purpose, understanding why is DEG Nangolo requesting that a drill rig be availed to him to go and resolve water issues on the reasonable farms. It's not because he wants to be difficult. He has a responsibility to make sure where they resettle people, there is water. Because without water, it's not an effective resettlement. Colleagues, I think maybe move towards the end, as you can read the rest of the statement in the media, but I know I've taken long. Let me just go towards the end of my statement. As I conclude, I'm learning to become a politician. The deputy minister and I and the governor are expecting that the outcomes of this workshop will be relevant, will be speedy, and will be responsive to the needs of the people on the ground. If at the end of the 3 days, whatever has been resolved here does not speak to the need of the people for food, water, land, and employment opportunities, improve livelihoods, you have not achieved what you have come out to do for here. So please, let us make sure we are relevant. And therefore, I want to guide your deliberation without giving a directive at the beginning of the workshop. But if your deliberations can address the following issues, then the Deputy Minister and I will be happy that it was time well spent, as well as the Governor. Therefore, under the Department of Agriculture Development, if at the end of the day, DEG Kwelane, that the timelines and completion for the erection of the veterinary cotton fence between Namibia and South Africa by end of this year, because we need to defend our livestock sector from FMD. And Cabinet has already approved that yes, we must erect a buffer zone in Tsara's region. So this is one of the outcomes that we want to reach, that yes, we are going to start on X date and we are going to end on X date. Number two, DEG Kwelane, Tsumi's Agricultural College and Mashare Agricultural Development Institute must be operational by September 2026. I already said that in the budget statement, so it's not news. You know it. Mr. Farazan, remember last year, September? We promised there has been delay. This cannot be delayed anymore. Number three, agriculture still. Please, Mr. Benani, dissolve agribusiness and integrate the people that are working in our green schemes into the ministry. How long has it been taking to just dissolve agribusiness? Cabinet decision, it's not me. Cabinet already decided. But of course there were processes, but the report has come December last year. This is the acting ED, MD of agribusiness. This is both to Mr. Nangolo and Mr. Kenani. The people of Tsara's region have waited for too long for the development of Lekatao Green Scheme. Please advertise the irrigable land around the Lekatao Dam. Harvest the water. Let the water be turned into productive resource by producing food for the country. And I want to challenge you, if possible, if not, you can come for extension by end of July 2026. Five, still under agriculture development, I want you, we want you, together with my deputy minister, this is a collective effort. Please, expression of interest for a triple P partnership for all our green schemes. We have said this in our budget statement because we didn't get sufficient budget allocation to expand production in our green schemes, that we will invite private partners to join us so that they can bring the capital to expand and to acquire the equipment that the green schemes need in order to increase food production. This one, possibly, DED come by September 2026. And I want us to finalize for the Mahenge region the development of an integrated feedlot at Farm Kehoro. Mr. Mulunga, under the leadership of DED Kenani, that process has already started. It has just been stalled in Kenani due to some things that we can resolve within a week at least. And then, number seven, since last year, we have been talking to UNAM and the University of Science and Technology that we want to sign MOUs so that they can support our research efforts and training. These MOUs are long overdue, Mr. Kenani. I know the one of NAST has been signed, but the one of UNAM is outstanding. Can we do so by end of May, please? Number eight. Manager responsible for maintenance. We want you to develop a comprehensive and costed maintenance plan for the ministry. All its assets. And this must be done. We can talk about the timelines, but by end of this year. Nine, you must fill all the critical vacancies in the National Plant Protection Division. Already in October, when we gathered at Mercury Hotel for the public-private forum, the SLSC directed we must build up the capacity for this division within the ministry. It's a very critical division, maybe you don't know, but the exports of all our produce, high-value produce, the imports of fertilizers and seeds is the DVS of plants. so to speak. Many of you are familiar with the work that is done by DBS. This one ought to be elevated to that level, because our stakeholders are complaining. Soon we'll lose our markets because we are not able to produce reports, our surveillance reports, to assure the markets that our produce are disease-free. We don't vaccinate grapes or blueberries, but we must make sure we have surveillance report to say that there were no flies in this plantation for the duration of the harvest. And if there were, what control measures do we have in place? And as the governor said also, I want us to review all the related policies and legislation insofar as plant health and plant protection is concerned. As we develop our agriculture, two of the critical inputs, which is seeds and fertilizers, we are importing them more than maybe 70% from imports. We need to develop our own capacity. We're talking about ammonia here at Daure's Green Hydrogen Project in the Rongo region. There are many stakeholders who want to enter into the sector of fertilizers production. But we have the law of 1920, maybe, 1947, that is not, was never designed for today's realities. Because at the time, Namibia was a fifth province of who? That one. So please make sure by end of this year, we are going to Parliament with new legislation. A land bill of the plant health must be produced in Simata by end of the year. And then you must review, I think this is for the ED, but it's specifically for the Department of Agriculture. Review, finalize the review of the structure of that department. When I was looking at the structure, there are so many critical vacancies that are budgeted for even. And this applies across the ministry. If you have a position of director and deputy director that are budgeted for and are vacant, this must be advertised as a matter of agency. So we're so happy to hear many people join the ministry in the last 12 months. We welcome them with applause. They are equally other Namibians, qualified, who want to come to the ministry. And ED, World 38, our scientists and all other professional staff within the ministries must be taken care of so that they don't leave. We don't want to lose them. They are the custodian of knowledge. And we want to, if I already directed, please make a submission. I'll motivate it. I'll handle it with the deputy minister to the powers and back.
Let's get into some scrutinizing right there. Of course, Namibia's fisheries sector is also currently at crossroads as experts are calling for strategic shift in order to maximize industry value. As Namibia seeks to strengthen its economic base, attention is increasingly turning to the country's fisheries sector, long regarded as one of the most sustainably managed sectors. However, insiders say that while the sector remains stable, it is not yet operating at its full economic potential. That the Ministry of Fisheries, Water and Land Reform is now being urged to adopt a more aggressive, growth-oriented approach aimed at unlocking greater value from the country's marine resources. For years, Namibia has focused on conservation and quota management to protect fish stocks, particularly within the productive Benguela current ecosystem. While this has ensured sustainability, experts argue that the next phase must prioritize industrial expansion and value creation. A key concern is the continued export of fish in low-value forms. Increasing local processing, such as filleting, canning, and packaging, could significantly boost export earnings and create jobs. Strengthening onshore activities would also reduce reliance on external markets for value addition. Another area under scrutiny is the allocation of fishing quotas. While quotas are intended to promote economic participation, there are concerns that some rights holders are not fully utilizing them for productive investment, that is, those who have rights to fishing quotas. Industry observers suggest that stricter enforcement measures, including use-it-or-lose-it policies, could ensure quotas translate into tangible outcomes such as employment, infrastructure development, and increased output. And then there's issue of addressing illegal fishing and system leakages. Although Namibia has relatively strong fisheries governance, so it says, paper, illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing remains a risk. Strengthening monitoring systems, including vessel tracking and port inspections, is seen as essential to safeguarding national revenue and maintaining sustainability standards. And then there's modern infrastructure and fleet upgrades that are necessary. Efficiency challenges also persist in parts of the sector. Upgrading fishing fleets, improving cold storage, and enhancing logistics, particularly through key hubs like Walvis Bay, could improve competitiveness within the global market. With agriculture identified as a growth frontier, and with wild fish stocks naturally limited, experts also emphasize the need to scale up aquaculture. Namibia's coastline and inland water systems offer opportunities for oyster farming, marine recipes cultivation, and freshwater fish production. However, the sector remains underdeveloped and requires targeted investment and policy support. And at this particular point in time, we have so many graduates also that are graduating, some with marine aquaculture degrees, biochemistry, and all those perhaps sort of like courses that are aligning towards the fishing sector and how to enhance it and how to advance it. And more practical reform could also to bring them on board. Fresh graduates may have ideas that could really position Namibia in such a pace that it competes highly. Of course, we're doing well in the fishing industry, sort of to say, but we could do better. There's still more that could be done. If we could leverage the opportunity now and even end up exporting more to those markets that we have already. And then there's the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. If we have something to offer that is completely unique and something completely different, that will also make us stand out. Now there's preparation for climate and environmental pressure. Climate variability is also emerging as a critical factor. Changes in ocean conditions could also significantly affect fish stock distribution and productivity as well, therefore making it necessary for policymakers to adopt adaptive management strategies and invest in scientific forecasting. And then there's a closing of skills gap that is necessary also at this particular point in time. Human capital remains another key constraint. Expanding training in marine sciences, in fisheries management and processing technologies, potentially in collaboration with institutions such as so many different universities that Namibia has, is also seen as an essential to supporting sector growth. And then there comes in the idea of adding skills to the already employees that are existing. Because remember, existing employees have experience, have the guidance and the expertise that is necessary. And they know the shortcomings, they know the limitations also perhaps of the company that they are working under, or perhaps they also know what is practical knowledge of being in the field out there. Now, if we could add on their skills, that could also position then the fishing sector at a position where they are operating at maximum, because you're increasing knowledge to them, to what they already know from their experiences. Finally, maintaining access to premium international markets will definitely depend on Namibia's ability to meet strict quality and sustainability standards, and strengthening certification systems and promoting the country's reputation as a responsible fishing nation could enhance its global positioning. As Namibia looks to diversify its economy, the fishing sector presents a clear opportunity. In the coming months, I expected to test whether strategic planning within the ministry would translate into measurable progress on the ground. With that being said, let's pause here, take a trip to the marketplace.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the mimo with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any other
station. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ipurane ngelo wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utite opoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune uto otukwetira o special geta shake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM Onora etatu imwe mbali heali Nola natu heali bali no heali Ile ko berewa Nora etatu natu Bali o etatu batatu Oma filane Eagle FM The Eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the Eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now let's get right into other news. Opposition leaders in Tanzania have rejected the findings of a government-appointed inquiry into the deadly unrest that followed the country's October 2025 general elections, arguing that the official death toll significantly underestimates the scale of the violence. The Commission of Inquiry, widely referred to as the Chande Commission and chaired by retired Chief Justice Mohamed Chande Othman, submitted its report to President Samia Suluhu Hassan at State House on the 23rd of April 2026. Now, the Commission concluded that at least 518 people were killed during post-election demonstrations and clashes between civilians and security forces. However, opposition parties, civil society groups, and some religious leaders have dismissed the report's findings, claiming the true number of fatalities ranges between 1,000 and 2,000 people. They accuse authorities of downplaying the extent of the violence and have called for an independent international investigation. Now, the unrest erupted after the October 2025 elections, in which President Hassan was declared the winner with 98% of the vote, an outcome that opposition groups disputed, alleging widespread irregularities, voter suppression, and lack of transparency in the electoral process. Now, protests broke out in several regions, with security forces reportedly using live ammunition and mass arrests to disperse demonstrators. Now, to get into further understanding, I'm joined by Mr. Andrew Nishitile. He's a researcher, and we're going to discuss unrest of Tanzania. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Andrew, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Yes, good afternoon, Happy, and good afternoon to the listeners.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me here.
A pleasure to have you indeed. Quite some disturbing news that I think we had put at the back of our mind, and it's only fair that it resurfaces at this point in time. I think before we even get into this report, let's get to speaking about what actually transpired last year, October 2025, where President Samia Suluhu Hassan was declared winner with 98% of votes. Is that even possible? I mean, in this day and age when we're talking about democracy, can we really see a ruling party won by 98%?
It's a big number to use. That is not really a transparent thing. Yeah, you have to come up with the numbers that convincing your support out there. And to look on that is an outcome. It's a threat to the result, to the election result, right? So, which people were not waited into all things to come out, and then they starting demonstrating. Thing. So, 97 is just a pickup number.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was not something that you can tell. Yeah, everybody is already asking about it, that how do you come concluding with you have about 40-50% demonstrating, and you are telling 70% of them they are cooling down in their houses and waiting for you to start your administration.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was one of the challenges that even Barack Obama criticizing that in Africa, we don't expect. Yes, but that is how it is when it comes to African countries.
Yeah.
So, to have a quiet democracy is not easy, or a transparent.
It's quite a challenge.
It's really hiding there. Yeah, it's not something that we can say, we are good in Africa. because we have nothing much to produce, especially if we look at the sectional title, which is economy, or you can getting your own properties or whatever you are generating in the industrial hub that we don't have. So you have to connect it with the president, and you have to connect with the administration that is ruling that country so that you can benefit it. So it's a quite really, really dangerous thing in Africa.
Indeed.
Yes, especially on those, we call it freedom fight parties. Yeah, that's also one of the challenges. If you look at the time of even the transaction of Zambia from Kaunda to Chiruba, it was one of the quietest thing to look, but it's unadopted by many. So that was also a problem,
Ms. Andrew, let's get now into the report, which has been rejected by opposition leaders, and I couldn't blame them, actually. Citing that about 518 people died during that uproar, but in actual fact, they are claiming that the true number of fatalities ranges between 1,000 and 2,000 people. And to top it off, this was a government-appointed inquiry, and they rather prefer or call for an independent international investigation. And my concerns are why an independent international investigation was not one that was instituted in the first place, considering that a lot of African people or African leaders were not really, or let me just say a couple of leaders and a lot of analysts as well, were not happy when the elections took place in Tanzania last year.
Yeah, I think for them to claim to have an independent investigator is that they want really to prove it, to prove what cause of the death, because out of these numbers that we got on the table, 518, 70% of these were having wound from guns or tortured and all of that. So which means they were, some of them, even the numbers are saying they have been killed in the houses. So they come, they targeted you, that you are the one who was influencing those people to go on the street. It's called it elimination, something like that. But political elimination. But this one, it was not targeting the politician, targeting the supporters. And to look on the thing also in the politician, they were protected because they arrested before that. That was one of the protection, because they were in jail already. It's not an influencer, because the influencer were outside. So they just wanted to prove that her supporters, especially in the army and police, they are the ones that are doing those. Remember, there was one video circulated with a police officer pulled the body. So that is one of the things that people wanting to show the world.
And interestingly, Namibia has been quite quiet on this matter. We have not really pronounced ourselves. I don't know who should pronounce themselves, perhaps the government or the president herself. Why do you think perhaps nothing has been said from the government's perspective?
In terms of SADC and in terms of condemning the Freedom Fight Party, and to look at where we're standing with Tanzania, it's a quite diplomatic. It's not something that is publicly condemned, to say it was not good for them, for the SADC. No. It's not like that. It's a way of how do they call it? A way of look and silence. Silence is a louder. It's something that is, you can see it's not good, because people lose their lives, and you bring fear among your people. So that is one thing also. And to look at that is that the women, when they are coming to power, they don't come to the stable political movement. So they come when there is a crisis, when there is a division in the party. So they're starting now to appointing one of that they thought it would be changed, it cool down the people and all of that. And this killing which happening, or the violence that happened in Tanzania, it was a matter of protecting the freedom, the ruling party. It was not a part of the gender, who was a leader at the time. Yeah, so that is what now our head of state, it has nothing to say it because of it's out of her hand comparing to the violence that happened, condemned by the whole entire.
Okay. Now, for human rights organizations that have documented allegations of excessive use of force, perhaps what then from the international aspect of view, from what perhaps can they do in regards to countries that continuously use power, you know, accessing democracy over the people? I mean, Uganda on itself, when their president, of course, over and over was contending to be the president, Magufuli, there was a time where he, in recently, where he closed down Facebook in Uganda. And as we speak, of course, Ugandans don't use Facebook. Rather, they are only allowed to use Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp, all because his opponent was more sort of like having more followers, or was more was more dominant on social media, being Facebook itself, and he closed it down. What does that say about the citizens of that country, for instance? Okay, that's something I believe Namibians will not stand to allow. But then what does it mean to citizens of that country, where they are sort of like suppressed and the government makes decisions for the leaders themselves and not for the people, not for the citizens?
Yes, the voiceless media is a voiceless, it's a fearless thing to campaign. And comparing to look at in Uganda, say, population generation, they are young people. And this is what the political system is losing power because of this campaign, which is giving more big data or big picture of supporting the opposition. So for you now to closing that mirror or pictures in that other people cannot see, is to closing out in those public media, which is it can be reaching the whole world, but to come up with something that can hide the whole information, like Twitter, you cannot posting the whole thing. It have limited of words that you are using. So you're campaigning, but it's taking you a whole day to finishing your campaign, to finishing addressing your campaign. And then the Facebook away, you are uploading the whole pictures, and then you're sending it to the public. So it's a very, very, as I said, in Africa, we don't really focus on creating economy good conducive so that people can get rid of participating in politics, then to benefiting in politics, which is now a big challenge. If you look in Uganda, say leader who have been there for years and years, and we don't want him to be called the dictatorship, because that is the one doesn't allow the others to come and rule.
Yeah.
So that is where the media is playing a big role to criticize, but he using powers to preventing it to be seen by the world.
Mm-hmm. And I just got the names mixed up. The Magufuli is obviously for Tanzania. Museveni being now for Uganda.
That is what we need to focus on economy, as I said. If we're starting building up economy like the way that is something I'm working on it, about the north, and to say, they need also to creating a hub of industrial where they can start making money instead of depending on the government job creation policy, which is not materializing to cutting everybody. or to giving jobs to everybody. So that is what we needed to start in thinking about it and look at where exactly are we going. And it's not easy in Africa to do this, because most of the wealth people, they are become friendly to the political leaders, especially in they try to be shaking hand with the president so that they can benefit from the administration, which is now a hub of economy if you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at in other countries in like United States, or you look at in UK, there isn't some people that are doing very well, creating jobs to massive of people, but they don't care to share a hand with the governor or a hand with the minister, as long as they are producing the policy that are protecting their business. And that is what also in Namibia we keep voting because of be protected in the safety of this country. Then that is what we are counted on our leader. But when it comes to political stable, we are still struggle to be there.
Interesting. Mr. Andrew, thank you so much for making time for us right here.
Yeah, you're welcome, Judy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you always. And there we had it from Andrew Nishitile, who is a researcher. Now, of course, regarding this, the Tanzania experienced violence on the 29th after young people took to the streets accusing their government of silencing their opposition, as the country's main opposition party leader remained in prison for treason, and the presidential candidate for the second largest opposition party was barred from running. The internet was shut down in the country for days, a move that President Samia Suluhu Hassan later apologized to the diplomatic community for and promised would never happen again. But it's already happened and she's in power. Hassan was seeking a second term in office after serving out the term of a predecessor, that is John Mango, fully after he died in office in 2021. And Hassan won with 98% of the vote, and some international observers say the election fell short of a free and fair vote. Othama recommended that a further investigation be conducted on the use of firearms. Some of the witnesses told the commission that their loved ones were shot while sitting inside their houses. Now, since the violence, 245 people remain unaccounted for, and 39 families reported having seen the bodies of their loved ones in morgues before they later disappeared. Now, the commission ruled out the presence of mass graves as alleged by human rights groups. The commission concluded that the demonstrations weren't peaceful, but were acts of violence based on their contravention of laws requiring a 48-hour police notice, and because it was an election day, thus denying some citizens the right to vote. Otan said that the protests were planned and coordinated by people who had been recruited and trained, and violence occurred simultaneously in various locations to confuse the police. Hassan said that the commission's findings will guide constitutional amendments and promised the establishment of a reconciliation commission. The president also announced the formation of a criminal investigation body to review the unrest, and she said that the body will identify those who planned, financed, and were involved in criminal acts such as looting and damaging infrastructure. It also investigate claims of missing bodies and allegations of abductions. And nonetheless, let me keep my two cents opinion to myself at this point in time. But nonetheless, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. This is On The Reading News Analysis. Now, should you be interested in sharing your opinion right here on the news analysis, 083-288-401 is the number in studio.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nweko dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwala. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitida mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. okukwetera oipindi konu Honda doinawa nune udo otukwetera o special ngeza shake ngejefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamoili nawa ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu oma felane Eagle FM the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now let's go to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Furthermore into it, but let's start off with Tanzania's post-election inquiry, which cites 518 deaths and unplanned unrest in disputed vote report.
For staying with us on Citizen Weekend, and as promised, I am now joined by Tito Magoti and Don Dea, who are in Tanzania. But before we get into that conversation on the Commission of Inquiry report on the October 29th, 2025 poll unrest, let's set the stage. A Commission of Inquiry into the unrest that was witnessed during the presidential election in Tanzania last year found that it was not spontaneous, but orchestrated by politicians and activists. The commission says money was paid and instruction given to disrupt the election. The report presented to President Samia Suluhu Hassan on Thursday, however, fell short of naming names. Tanzania's President Samia Suluhu Hassan, however, says a special investigative team will pursue prosecution.
Tukio ya ghasia ya 29 October.
518 is the number of lives a commission of inquiry says were lost
New
in the
research.
Election violence witnessed on October 29th, 2025. The number of deaths have hitherto been both a contested and a closely guarded secret in Tanzania. While acknowledging the number could be higher, the commission, however, found no evidence of mass graves, saying some of the images that made their rounds on social media were doctored.
Na mfano, mojawapo, ni picha ambayo imetumika mara nyingi, kuonesha maiti, zikiwa kwenye mifuko ya blue, zikizikwa kwenye makaburi ya halaiki. Picha hiyo, kwa mujibu wa uchunguzi, imekuwa imetumika sehemu nyingi duniani.
Another claim by the commission is that the protests witnessed during and after the presidential poll were planned.
Matukio ya ghasia ya 29 October yalipangwa, yaliratibiwa, yalifadhiliwa na kutekelezwa na watu waliopata mafunzo.
The commission, however, steered clear of naming names, saying it would fall to the investigative authorities, as would reports of police successes.
Vifo vingi vilitokana katika idadi hiyo kupigwa risasi, ambayo ni vifo 197, sawa na 90%, maiti 166 zilikuwa na majeraha ya sehemu ya mkono na miguu.
Receiving the report,
wasitoke watu wengine wakadai ownership ya ripoti hii. Ni ripoti ya rais. Nilisema tume za huko nyuma zilikuwa zinabanwa kimya.
Okay, let's now turn our focus into South Africa, as South Africa focuses on its water crisis.
It's a constitutional right in South Africa. However, for years there have been growing concerns about how the country's most vital natural resource is being managed, with conditions steadily worsening in many areas. For more on this, we're joined by Water and Sanitation Deputy Minister David Mahlobo and WaterCan's Communication Manager Jonathan Erasmus. Thank you so much for joining me. Deputy Minister, I want to start the conversation with you. South Africa has a worrying water crisis that seems to be worsening rather than government getting a grip on it, from its management to its distribution at various levels of government. And oftentimes we see that the coordinating role that the national government plays is not enough, and that a lot of the rot and malfeasance that happens in local government, such as, for instance, the abuse of procurement regulations when it comes to water tankers, for instance, are still going on unabated. Talk to us about the state of remedying South Africa's water resources since the introduction of the national coordinating body that the president had introduced.
No, thank you so much, Oliver, and thanks for the viewers and to our panelists. We just want to confirm that when it comes to water resources in our country, a lot of good work is being done to ensure that the country does not run out of water by the year 2030. That's why over the last few days you saw President Cyril Ramaphosa accompanied by Minister Phemi Majordina and supported by myself, wherein we went to the Kingdom of Lesotho, our project of Pudihadi Dam to bring water to more than 1 billion cubic meters per annum into South Africa is well on track. At least by the year 2029, there will be more water coming into our country, and more major infrastructure projects are being rolled out to ensure that water security, whether in the Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and others, we don't have that particular problem. Our biggest challenge is what you say, which is about water services and sanitation, supply and reliability. About a few, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Minister Majordina released the green drop reports and progress report on no drop and the blue drop. The performance is not impressive. At the very same time, it's part of being accountable. President has started with his engagements with all the ministers that are relevant in terms of the National Water Crisis Committee. Subsequent to that, a meeting has taken place with the Presidential Coordinating Council. And by the end of this week, we will convene all the municipalities under one roof so that we can come in and support local government in as much as it is their responsibility to ensure that you and me, we get sustainable water supply that is reliable. But those that are struggling, we've reached a point that national government is not going to be sitting idly. We shall intervene within the law, bring our own entities that have the capability, but more importantly, also draw the capacities that exist in private sector and other experts, because the water issue now has reached a crisis proportion that we are violating human rights in terms of access, but more importantly, we're also impacting on business confidence that we need that they can be able to invest in a country, that there's a guarantee for water, so they can create the necessary employment that we need for the economy.
Minister, just maybe, and I would hope for a brief answer on this, why is the national government still allowed local authorities who have demonstrated a habitual pattern of malfeasance in the administration of water and water resources to continue to bear the responsibility? Let's talk about municipalities that lose up to 50% of the water that has been pumped to them during reticulation. More than that, they don't collect enough on that water, and even that which they collect, they mismanage those funds and don't use it for the necessary work that needs to be done. And, of course, paying their water suppliers like Joburg Water, Rand Water, for instance, in certain places. Why is nothing drastic being done about that?
We have some limitation constitutionally. Remember, the constitution is very clear. The national sphere of government is not a bigger sphere than the other sphere. The function for water constitutionally in terms of the Schedule 4 is clearly delineated in terms of water delivery to municipalities. Ours is to support, but if we need to intervene, we'll have to demonstrate that we have used Section 154 of the Constitution before we invoke Section 139, including Section 63 of the Water Services Act. But in certain instances where there have been poor performance, our own ministry, we have taken a decision working with National Treasurer, rather than to deploy the grants directly to these non-performing municipalities, we have decided to go for indirect grants where we use Schedule 6B, and ourselves as national government were implementing some of those particular projects. But the decisions that we are referring to of ring fencing of infrastructure, it's just a management and a leadership decision. It does not require regulation that a mayor with his full or her full consent must just know that all trading services like water and electricity, you ring fence, so that when you sweat the asset, you can't be able to invest on the asset. But on issues of corruption like water tinkering, we're outlawing it. We have set municipalities by your own so that you can be able to remove these issues of private tankers.
Yet, Deputy Minister, we see a lot of municipalities not doing that. Still, of them rely on the outsourcing of that service. Jonathan, I want to bring you into the conversation. Does South Africa need an overhauling of its water resource administration?
Well, it's a very, very broad question, and I suppose the short.
In other very good news, even in South Africa, teenage pregnancy has reportedly dramatically dropped.
New research published in the South African Medical Journal found that adolescent birth rates dropped by 16% across all 9 provinces between 2021 April and March 2025. The steepest decline was amongst girls aged 10 to 14, whose birth rates fell by nearly 40%. Researcher and honorary associate professor in the School of Public Health at Wits University, Professor Peter Barron, joins us now for more. He was leading the team of researchers on this. Prof. Barron, thank you so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it. I want to preface this conversation by showing you a number of reactions from our viewers to the question, what their thoughts are on the decline of adolescent and teenage pregnancy rates in South Africa. And this is what a number of them had to say, calling into question or at least presenting skepticism around the veracity of the number. Take a look. Those will appear on your screen in a very short moment. And while we do bring that up onto the screen, talk to us about the credibility and veracity of these numbers. What was the methodology that was followed in determining these rates?
We took the database that is hosted by the National Department of Health of all the births that took place in the public sector in South Africa over those 4 years. Every clinic or community health center that delivers babies, every district hospital, every regional hospital, and every tertiary or academic hospital has births, and they submit on a monthly basis these birth numbers to the National Department, where they get put into a database and aggregated and analyzed. So that was the basis for our research.
Prof, perhaps to ask this question, and I do note in the numbers that there has been a general decline in fertility rates in South Africa over the same period. How much of a contributing factor was that to the overall outcome of the decline in adolescent and teenage pregnancies?
Well, there's been a general decline in births over that period, and the reason for this is not absolutely clear. We can speculate about that, but our research was just to give a scientific basis for the numbers. More research is required to know exactly what is causing these declines.
What were the most significant contributing factors to the decline? Does the research explore that question, Prof?
No, not at all. This is speculation, and I can speculate for you and give you some possible reasons, but that's not our research didn't look into these reasons at all.
What were you able to distill in the pattern of the declines? It seems as though the sharpest declines were in rural provinces like the Northwest, the Free State, and the Eastern Cape. In fact, the Eastern Cape had and the Free State had declines of in excess of 23% for certain age groups. Does the research explain that at all?
As I said, there are some speculative reasons, and I can tell you if you're interested, but the research is really looking at the numbers and describing the numbers. And in every province, in every year, there was a decline from 2021 through to 2025. So it's unlikely to be a data error. It's likely to be something significant, but we don't know for sure what the reasons were.
Yeah. Other indices that you had recorded and studied in this instance were things like the use of abortions and terminations to an extent, perhaps contraceptives as well. Talk us through that.
Yes, abortions in the public sector, also known as termination of pregnancy, had a contributing factor to the adolescent pregnancy rate. But in fact, it wasn't a major contributing factor. The real factor is that the birth numbers are declining year on year. And it could be that people are pessimistic about the future. This occurred immediately after the COVID pandemic. It might be that people are pessimistic about the future. The world is.
Let's move on to other news. Ghana unveils a national AI strategy in order to boost its digital economy.
A milestone in Ghana's digital innovation space, the launch of a national artificial intelligence strategy in Accra now paves way for the country to fully integrate the technology into Ghana's development agenda.
The strategy strongly recommends adopting a producer-led approach by establishing a natural language processing center of excellence to develop AI tools in our local Ghanaian languages.
Ghana has already started adopting AI in its healthcare system, education, and agriculture, and there are concerns that the technology could take over people's jobs.
We'll invest in upskilling and reskilling our public sector workforce and support workers across sectors to adapt and thrive in this new era. We do not intend to surrender our people to technological disruptions.
The government says it will invest $250 million to set up a world-class AI computing center and an additional $20 million for the implementation of the AI strategy.
As we implement this strategy, the government recognizes that strong legal and institutional frameworks must support our policy.
The government says it is working on a law to regulate the use of AI. Experts believe for Ghana's tech ecosystem, the national AI strategy could be a game changer.
It means there's a pure readiness to be aggressive in the adoption and, you know, use case of AI solutions. So the plus side is, you know, for people who are working on AI, if it is healthcare, agriculture, if it's transportation, now you know that government wants those solutions. Government is interested in implementing that.
The National Artificial Intelligence Strategy is expected to be implemented within a 10-year period.
There is a clear push for Ghana to be at the forefront of digital innovation in Africa with this new National Artificial Intelligence Strategy. But experts say beyond the big vision, the real challenge will be in the execution. They want the government to strengthen partnerships with industry leaders to quickly turn the strategy into real opportunities to drive economic growth. Nabil Ahmed Rufai, CGTN, Accra, Ghana.
The World Health Summit regional meeting for 2026.
Economic shocks at the moment from Israel's and the United States' war on Iran have made it much harder.
A World Health Summit for Africa has begun here in Nairobi. The high-level gathering has brought together policymakers, health experts, innovators, and global partners in an effort to shape the future of health systems across the continent. Organizers say the summit will focus on innovation and integrating health systems, strengthening primary health care, and expanding access through digital solutions. Delegates will be looking in particular at scalable solutions and how to foster cross-border collaboration for efficient, equitable, and sustainable health systems. What comes out of the summit can often guide policy, help attract investment, and strengthen partnership in the sector. Our reporter Daniel Arap Moy is covering the summit in Nairobi, and he joins us live from there. Daniel, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. Daniel, has the meeting begun, and who is in attendance?
Yes, Richard, the meeting has begun here at the United Nations complex in Kigiri, where over 2,000 delegates, that is according to the secretariat here at the complex, there are about 2,000 delegates who are attending this health summit. And we also have a key among the people that are actually attending this summit, experts, innovators, and policymakers. But of course, we have health ministers from at least 50 African countries, and also finance ministers from at least 50 African countries. Now, well, there's a reason for having both finance ministers and health ministers in this particular meeting, because the question is about reimagining Africa's health, and that requires money, and money is appropriated by members of parliament through the Minister of Finance. So there are finance ministers here.
Get top scores. Yes, marathon savings at USAVE. Rexona Shield Roll On Deodorant, $22.99 million. 8 Caris sanitary pads, just $6.99 million. 500 milli Nuden Pine Gel Surface Cleaner, $24.99 million. 2 kilo bag Surf hand washing powder, only $49.99 million. And Dry Nips Premium Disposable Nappies, just $139.99 million. Hurry to your favorite. You save.
That are attaining this summit to ensure that the goal that they have set up, reimagining Africa's health system, is achieved. So quite a number of people here, Richard, and in the next 3 days, they'll be discussing key issues that we will be looking at here. But earlier on, we did listen to President William Ruto, the Kenyan president, who addressed the opening ceremony together with the president of the summit, who also addressed the gathering here. And this is what President Ruto and the president had to say, the summit president rather had to say.
We are believers, and I dare say very strong believers, in multilateralism and collective action. This summit is anchored on a clear and urgent imperative. It calls on us to reimagine Africa's health systems through innovation, integration, and interdependence. It challenges us to design practical pathways that translate into better outcomes for health in our continent.
It's very significant for Africa in these times of a changing global health ecosystem to raise its voice, to show its strength, and to take initiative. We need to signal to Africa, to the many countries in Africa, but also to the entire world, that health is still a number one priority, and it has to be addressed by any country in a way where the countries take sovereignty but work together very intensively. And that's the main message from here.
Daniel, you talked about it initially in your earlier answer. Talk to us about those key issues that delegates are expected to address over the next 3 days. What are they?
Well, Richard, one of the main key issues to be addressed in this summit here in Kigiri, Richard, is the question of the health reach to the people down the grassroots. So what this summit is trying to address is that how do we reach out to the local people down the grassroots so that they're able to access health services, you know, just like other people across the world? Because according to what we've had here, 50% of the people across Africa are unable to access medical services, especially those that are in hard-to-reach areas. So this meeting is trying to address that, and they're trying to address that using technology and innovation, that somebody can sit in a village, but they're able to access diagnostic using phones, you know. So this is what the meeting is saying, that we need to make sure that all our people can access health services. Because you're saying here, Richard, that we can never develop if our population are sick. You know, we can never have quality education if our people are sick. So this is what the meeting is saying, that we need to address this. But also another key challenge that they are trying to address is how do they marshal resources together? So the ministers of finance are here and the ministers of health are here to ensure that governments are able to speak in one voice. If they are to collect funds to support the health system, can they do it collectively? Can they speak with one collective voice to ensure that Africa is heard and Africa is not just at the background this time? They want Africa to lead the cause. We are talking about diseases that are affecting the continent. And these are the areas that they want to invest in it as a continent, as a collective, not just as African Union, but as a collective, Richard.
All right. Daniel Arap Moi speaking to us right here in Nairobi. Thanks for that.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage.
Let us look at lessons East Africa can learn from mega Lagos refinery project.
Economic shocks at the moment from Israel's and the United States war on Iran have made it much harder for African nations to raise funds for development abroad. That said, a new report published by the Africa Finance Corporation argues that, in fact, the continent's domestic capital base is now at a scale that exceeds external financing flows over the last decade. And the authors of this report argue that it's more than enough to fund the continent on growth and industrialization needs. The AFC's State of Africa's Infrastructure Report 2026 was launched on the sidelines of the AFC's inaugural Africa We Build Summit in Nairobi. CGTN's Uche Okoronkwo was at event. She filed this report.
Africa's richest man, Aliko Dangote, plans to build a refinery in East Africa identical to his 650,000-barrel-a-day refinery in Nigeria. He revealed this for the very first time on a panel at the Africa Finance Corporation's inaugural Africa We Build Summit in Nairobi, where we saw him also challenge Kenya's President William Ruto and Uganda's Yoweri Museveni to commit to a strategy.
Even now, I can give commitment to the two presidents that were here. If they will support the refinery, we'll build the identical one that we have in Nigeria, 650,000 barrels, with the likes of Afreximbank, with the likes of Africa Finance Corporation, with a lot of support from other financial institutions. Following these two, there's nothing we cannot do in Africa. That's why we, as a group, we have now launched between now and 2030, we're investing $40 billion in various fields.
I dare say, ladies and gentlemen, we have this in this room. We have the political leadership, we have the industrialists, we have the financiers to transform our continent, and we must waste no time looking any further.
Much like this exchange, this year's Africa We Build Summit opened the floor for government officials, leading infrastructure financiers, fund managers, investors, and industry leaders to not just talk money, but also realize deals for infrastructure projects across Africa. However, this year, a new report by the Africa Finance Corporation is advocating for a different approach.
Now, Africa has just over $2 trillion US dollars in non-bank domestic capital pools. Now, here at the inaugural Africa We Build Summit here in Nairobi, the Africa Finance Corporation says that that is more than enough to significantly fund and provide the capital needed to fund Africa's development.
The AFC's 2026 State of Africa's Infrastructure Report advocates for a new kind of funding, one that taps into the over $1 trillion U.S. dollars in domestic pension and insurance assets in Africa, or the $530 billion in central bank reserves as of 2025. The message here is Africa can do it all by herself. The constraint is no longer capital mobilization, but how to deploy it. However, the critics point to a fragmented system where risk is still a very real concern. Well, I sat down with the AFC's chief economist and director of research and strategy, Dr. Rita Babihugan-Sanze, to get some insight into how stakeholders, both public and private, could get on board with a plan like this.
The safety point is a real one. You know, it's a valid one. And so what we're saying is that we talk about this intermediation that needs to happen, this sort of building out of the financial architecture. Part of that has to do with how do you build guarantee structures, safety nets, that essentially, you know, provide a kind of a credit enhancement for pension funds, right? So whether it's first loss structures where the African DFIs go in first and provide that first layer of safety for the pension funds to come in on top.
Now, this is not necessarily a new concept. Initiatives such as the Lobito Corridor, as well as emerging national infrastructure financing vehicles like the Kenya National Infrastructure Fund, prove that it is possible to integrate systems where capital and policy align with major infrastructure projects. Uchiyo Korongkwa, CGTN, Nairobi.
All right, then let's bring in Tilewa Adebajo, CEO of CFG Advisory, joining us live on the program from Lagos. Thank you for your time this evening, sir. I want to start with the situation with the Dangote refinery in Nigeria. We saw a lot of arguments in the country over the importation of refined fuel products, even as the refinery was coming online, and it can meet Nigeria's domestic demand. For this proposed refinery in East Africa to work, countries would have to phase out refined fuel imports, won't they?
Indeed, but it's also important that we dimension this, and I think the whole essence of the African Continental Free Trade Area, this is a good way to start. It is the entrepreneurs that will make this happen. And just to dimension what we're talking about, Africa as a whole produces between 7 to 10 million barrels of oil a day, not to talk about its reserves. That's like 10% of global production. Where we have the shortfall is in the refining. Our consumption is about between 4 to 5 million barrels a day. But currently, we have a shortfall of about 1 million to 1.5 million barrels a day in terms of refining capacity on the continent. So it's quite ridiculous that we have a production of the oil, but we can't refine it. And that's the same problem in Nigeria. Now, Dangote's refinery came online, and not only does it meet domestic production, it's exporting to Europe. And, of course, he's now building the second phase of the refinery. So I think what we should do is that these are the exact opportunities we're talking about when we talk about an African Continental Free Trade Area. And Dangote has the EPC capacity to deliver this project. And we have companies like the African Finance Corporation, you've just been talking about, and the Afriexim Bank that can put together a syndication that could fund this transaction with a lot of other investors across the continent. So for me, I see this as a no-brainer.
And just in terms of stimulating demand, right, under the CFTA, because these are countries that have simply said, you know what, let's take in each other's products at preferential rates. So we could essentially be creating the price signal, right, to essentially stimulate domestic demand and create the domestic market, right, for that product.
Exactly. And I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. And that is really what we need to do. We need to begin to create value. We should stop importing and, you know, making refineries in Europe more profitable. We have the capacity locally. We have the oil. We have the gas. The production is there. It's just a question of the refining. And I think that these are the strategic investments we need to make across the continent, not only in West Africa, but also in Central Africa, Southern Africa, to make sure that with the lessons we're seeing from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, Africa is on the Atlantic seaboard and also on the Indian Ocean. So we, our own supplies have not been affected by this. And Dangote right now is supporting, is supplying a significant amount of his Jet A1 fuel to the European markets, because we don't have any conflict on this side of the continent. So that is a strategic advantage, not only to supply the Europeans, but I think the lesson now is that we need to use this as a strategic investment for energy security and energy self-sufficiency in Africa.
Crude oil production in East Africa is still, relatively speaking, except with the exception of South Sudan, it's still in its relatively early stages. From your perspective, does it make it easier for a potential refinery in the region to source the crude oil it needs to operate as compared to the experience the Dangote refinery had, where a lot of Nigerian crude had already been committed and therefore the refinery had to buy oil from foreign sources, including Brazil and the United States?
Yes, don't forget the Dangote refinery, for about 15, 20 years in Nigeria, there was no local refining. So that oil was committed. Eventually, those contracts are going to expire and Dangote will have the rights on that crude oil production. That's just a question of time. But the question is that we have oil on the continent and we can source oil from Angola, from Nigeria, from Chad, from Egypt, from Algeria, and, you know, all over, pending when the East Africans bring on their capacity to the markets. So setting up these refineries and getting oil and getting committed oil is something the African Union and the politicians should lead to ensure that oil is being committed for refinery, for self-sufficiency. So it's just a question of time and having a deliberate strategy. We need to be intentional.
One last question for you. The refinery, the Dangote refinery in Nigeria, will be listed at some point. Aliko Dangote has made that quite clear. Do you think, though, that it should come to market as a standalone company, or does it make sense to sort of package it with the East African refinery? Because he said that he wants to make this a Pan-African listing, right, with shares at the JSC, at the Nairobi Securities Exchange, in Lagos, perhaps even in Casablanca and Cairo.
Well, it's important he has that Pan-African listing because he can also go to the market for another rights issue to fund the East African operation. So it's a question of having a holding company and having each subsidiary being completely differentiated. But I think it's still quite early in the days to say so. But the benefits of having a Pan-African listing is that he can source capital if he needs it for expansion, you know, across, you know, the continent as a whole. And when the refinery in East Africa eventually it comes off the drawing board, then you could now look at the corporate finance strategy in terms of the best options to be able to look at that. You know, but I think that it's a step in the right direction because currently we have a shortfall of about 1.5 to 2 million barrels of refining capacity on the continent, despite the fact that our production is between 7 to 10 million barrels a day.
Indeed. Tiliwa Adebajo, CEO at CFG Advisory, joining us there live from Lagos. Thank you. Now-
and with that being said, we have come to the conclusion after this episode of On The Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkona Nadingi program brought to you by Luise Shimi.